Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host for this program. Today, we're going to be exploring the world of an increasingly serious white-collar crime, identity theft. Joining me in the discussion is one of the best-known experts on the subject. He has appeared on all of the major networks and has been quoted in just about every newspaper you can think of, and is also a frequent contributor to Blogger News. Robert Siciliano is a security consultant with Intellius.com. Robert, welcome to the program, and thanks so much for taking time out to talk with us today.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
Could we start with a little history? Who is Robert Siciliano?
I have been involved in personal security as it relates to violence prevention ever since I was a kid. And as I grew older and violence meant also being mugged, which was theft, my personal interests and my business began to revolve around violence prevention and theft prevention in the physical worlds. And over the years, as I got online as a small business and got hacked, my focus became on theft prevention in the virtual world as well. So it's been an evolutionary process for me. When I was 12, at the ripe old age of 12, my dad gave my brother and I a pretty long leash. He would allow us to do quite a bit and gave us a lot of responsibility. And he let us go into downtown Boston, which we were in the suburb of Boston. And we took the train and we were going shopping one day. And we went to like the heart of town called Downtown Crossing. Heavily pedestrian traffic, lots of stores and so forth. And we were approached by these five kids who surrounded us, and they demanded our money. Now, my brother was 9, I was 12, so I was in charge. They demanded our money, and, you know, I didn't really know what to do or how to respond. I mean, that was obviously the first time in my life where I had been approached like that. And my first gut reaction was, no, you can't have our money. And I think I might have said something profane at the time. And then these kids proceeded to take my money. They basically went into my pockets, knocked me on the ground, kind of beat me up a little bit, took my cash and change, and left. They all ran away. And that was my first experience with violence, with multiple attackers, with theft. And, you know, here I am supposed to be the big brother, and I'm on the ground and all bloodied and bruised and now without any money to even go back in the train. So that one experience, you know, back in the day, you know, it had a profound effect in the way I viewed the world. And what I did, you know, shortly afterwards, you know, I just got home and my dad saw what happened, and he, you know, saw that obviously he had not prepared Michael and I for, my brother and I for, what had happened. And so, you know, he sat us down and he began to explain to us that not everybody is as nice as mommy and daddy, and that there are some bad people out there in the world, and here are all the different things that you need to do to protect yourself. And he explain that to us by making us watch the PBS documentaries, the public broadcasting system shows on animals, you know, because kids kind of relate to things that are furry. And so he would make us watch, like, you know, The Predator. He'd show us how the lion who's out in the Serengeti, who is a predator who's stalking their prey, like the lion would have their eyes right above the grass line and they're stalking through the grass, and they see a whole herd of gazelle, and the gazelle would be out there in the fields with their head down, not paying much attention to the surroundings, and the lion would begin to run, and he'd chase, and eventually he'd catch one of his victims, the gazelle, and he'd take him to the ground, and he'd kill them, and he'd eat them. And my dad would explain to us that, first of all, the lion being a predator, and then the gazelle is its natural prey, and that it's normal and it's okay for that lion to kill, that it's just part of nature, and that in the human world, unfortunately, it's pretty much the same thing, that we, you know, are surrounded by predators all day, every day, that there is a certain element of society that, for whatever reason, just the way that they're raised or the way that they're born or whether it's nurture or nature, their job in society is to prey upon other people. And they may look like us, they may act like us, but they don't think like you and I do. That they don't have the same boundaries as you and I do. That they don't have the same care and compassion and values and sympathy and empathy for other human beings. And when you think about it, it makes an awful lot of sense because, you know, about 1% of society is basically bad, that they just come out of the womb as bad, and about 1% of society is in jail, too. And these are people that the Mayo Clinic says suffers from something called antisocial personality disorder. And so someone who has antisocial personality disorder is, again, someone who just, you know, doesn't have the same values and morals and ethics and sympathy and empathy. And they're all around us. They've always have been, they are, and they always will be out there. And so our jobs are to be aware and alert and know that this is going on, that there are bad people out there, and that there are things that we can and should do to protect ourselves. And so what I've spent my life's energy doing is studying this and understanding this and then effectively communicating it to all those around me. And I did this early on when I became a victim of crime. And then a year later, at the age of 13, I went to summer camp, you know, like a lot of kids do. And I met a girl at summer camp. And, you know, back then, which was, you know, like 27 or so years ago, kids didn't know what sex was. We didn't know what rape was. Like, we didn't have that knowledge. We didn't have MTV back then. So we didn't have this understanding of the world and how, and the birds and the bees and all that stuff like kids do today. And so, you know, I met this girl and she liked me. I liked her, and I'm hanging out on her porch one day and we're sitting down, and she says to me, and I'm 13 and she's 12. She says to me that her mother's boyfriend raped her. Now, yeah, exactly. Now, I don't even know what sex is, never mind rape. So I go home and I say, hey, Dad, what is rape and what is sex? So here I am, 13 years old. You know, I've already been a victim of crime. I meet this girl. She tells me that this happened to her. And my father explained to me about the birds and the bees and forcible rape in the exact same conversation. So now that obviously had a profound effect in the way I viewed the world. And from that point on, being a victim, understanding about sex crimes, I began to, you know, hear in the voices of people who were victimized. I began to gravitate towards people who were victimized, and they to me. And so I started to have a sense for the world unlike those around me and didn't see things like others did. And I understood that there were very bad people out there, and I understood what their motivations were. And I began to pick up on human behavior. And from that point on, I really, you know, spent, you know, a lot of time and energy and effort studying all of this and taking self-defense classes and watching videos and consuming information in books and magazines and gravitating towards professions around personal security such as barroom bouncing and personal bodyguarding and training on self-defense. And, I mean, this really has been my life's work ever since I was a kid. And with my business being hacked in the mid-90s, seeing that, you know, theft wasn't just in the physical world, you know, breaking into a house or being mugged, but it was also in the virtual world, I was fascinated by how all this occurred. And then when that happened to me, when I was hacked and credit cards and products went out the door, and here I am just a really small business, I began to study that. I became fascinated and intrigued with it. And I started to study hackers, you know, both good hackers and bad hackers, and how they did what they did. And, you know, having a penchant for technology myself, you know, I began to, you know, spend a lot more time in that world and began to, you know, socialize with people who were both good hackers and bad hackers and studied what they did and have always been fascinated, kind of in the same way where, like, you know, someone likes a particular brand of music or a particular band and they become a groupie. Well, I became like a groupie for hackers. Like, I saw what they did and how they did it, and was always amazed by it. And to this very day, I'm amazed by their brilliance, both the good guys and the bad guys. And after I was hacked, a good friend of the family, was her identity was stolen. And this is like 1999, before identity theft was something that the public had any real awareness of. And I didn't know what identity theft was either. It was just, you know, a whole new thing to me. And when this occurred, you know, what happened to her was that somebody had gone through her mailbox and they stole her mail, and they began to open up numerous financial accounts under her name. And then on one particular day, she got a phone call from JCPenney, JCPenney being a big retailer. And the retailer called and said, "Hey, you know, we have your curtains, they're ready. You can come pick them up, or we can ship them to your home. What do you want to do?" And she was also, you know, obviously stymied by the call because she hadn't placed any order for curtains. And she called JCPenney up and, you know, got some more information and found out that, you know, there was $3,000 order was sitting there for her. And, you know, she wasn't about to pay for that. And she called me asking me what I thought about it. And we began to investigate it. We called the police, and the police didn't really know what to do at that time. And we, you know, made a bunch of phone calls to JCPenney. We found out the address that the curtains were supposed to go to. And we did a little more investigation and found out that, you know, there was a particular woman in a particular dress who was getting mail under my friend's name. And we, you know, called the police back and told them what was going on. They did some investigating as well. And they determined that this woman had 45 prior convictions for fraud. That exactly. So here we have a career criminal who's been doing this her entire life, who stole my friend's identity, and she wasn't in jail for it. And back then, the punishment for this type of fraud did not fit the crime. That law enforcement really didn't know what to do with these types of people and these types of crimes. That they would let them go because it was considered a victimless crime. That, you know, it was just opening up fraudulent accounts, but it affected credit card companies and banks, and it was only for $1,000 or a couple of $1,000. So nobody really got hurt. It wasn't any violence involved, and it's a bank. You know, they just write it off. So they didn't do anything about it back then. But we did get a cop that took an interest in this particular case, because 45 prior convictions is nothing to shake a stick at.
Right.
And so eventually they picked this woman up. They arrested her, and she was eventually prosecuted. Now, in 2000, my friend got a prosecution, and this woman with 45 prior convictions, she received a one-year suspended sentence, which means she didn't spend a day in jail. She got off with a hand slap, and more than likely it went out and did it again. And so when I saw that happen, you know, what had happened to me and my process and, you know, going from violence to theft and from physical world to virtual world, and see what happened to my friend, and that the woman had no, you know, real conviction of any kind, I said that identity theft is going to be the biggest thing ever. This is going to be one of those things that's going to affect millions and millions of people, that, you know, we're all going to be affected by this crime someday. And that was back in 2000. And here we are today, 2010, 10 years later, and, you know, I've been speaking about it, writing about it, you know, working on this issue, and it's as big today as any crime is. It really is the perfect crime that at any given point in time, anybody can assume your personal information, they can assume your name, they can become you. We're no more advanced in our technologies and abilities to identify who's who today than we were a decade ago. At least we haven't implemented the necessary technologies to identify who's who. You know, to this very day, anybody can get a fake ID, and they can become you, and they can open up numerous financial accounts under your name. And until there's a significant change in the system, we're going to continue to have some serious problems in our hands.
Identity theft seems to be growing at an absolutely alarming rate. Now, I am no expert on the subject, but I was reflecting on the question of why earlier this morning. And it seems to me, if I had to pin it on a culprit, I have to blame it on technology. Computers, cell phones, ATMs, debit cards, etc. Am I on the right track there?
You know, certainly technology has dumped all kinds of fuel on the fire. There's no question about it that the availability of information online and in databases and so forth is definitely a significant part of the problem. you know, when the internet was born, as far as the World Wide Web is concerned, back in the early 90s, you know, there was government intranets, you know, ARPANET, that was sharing data and so forth. And the early hackers, you know, they saw the opportunity, they saw how easily and readily available information was. And through the years, we've become a database society. That said, what that means is that all of our information is on a database, a single database, on multiple databases, and so on. And that certainly has attributed to the problem. You know, when you look at some of the major breaches of data that have occurred over the past decade, one of them being a laptop computer that was stolen out of the home of a Veterans Administration employee. One laptop computer had 26.5 million names, addresses, and social security numbers of veterans and their families. And when you have almost 10% of the entire population on one computer, then you know we have a problem on our hands. So in that respect, technology has certainly added fuel to the fire. But, you know, what studies show that a lot of identity theft that occurs on the inside of an organization, meaning that those that have direct access to the data, whether it's in a filing cabinet or in a database, from the inside, are often the perpetrators of the crime. So those who, you know, handle your information, like a human resource officer who has direct access to all the employees' data, she develops herself a little crack problem, let's say. She meets this guy at a bar, and they fall in love, and next thing you know, he's got this little, you know, meth problem, and they're smoking the stuff and snorting the stuff, and she develops this issue as well. And before you know it, he's telling her to dip into the filing cabinet to get this data so he can steal some identities because he knows a guy who can get credit cards and so forth. That obviously is the root of the problem. It's a people problem. You know, while data is out there and so forth, it's still a people problem. And what comes in the mail sits on your desk and sometimes goes out in the trash. All that paperwork in our lives has always been a problem as far as identity theft is concerned, because paper really is the path of least resistance to stealing someone's identity. Your statements, what's on them, what you throw away, that's always, always been an issue. And so while technology certainly is a problem, paper actually is a bigger problem. You know, when you think about it like this, you know, I do a lot of presentations around this issue, and it was in a program not too long ago, and a woman, you know, was talking about shredding your data, shredding your paperwork, your throwaway paperwork, and she raised her hand and she said, you know, something happened to me a couple of weeks ago that really floored me. My local police didn't do enough to help me. I said, well, what happened? She said, I was, you know, in my kitchen, and I just made a cup of coffee, and it was trash day. And she said, I just happened to be looking out the window, and, you know, my trash is sitting out on the curb, and a guy in a pickup truck came by her house, parked in front of her house real quick, jumps out of his truck, goes through her trash, and takes her trash bags and throws it in the back of his pickup truck, right? And so she sees this happen, and she called the police station, and she said, she called the police station all in a panic, frantic. She said, someone just stole my trash. And the cop, you know, there's like a moment of silence. He's like, ma'am, I don't understand what you mean. And she said, somebody just came up to my in front of my house. They threw my trash bags in the back of the pickup truck. They stole my trash. And the cop says to her, he said, ma'am, I don't understand. If it was trash, how could somebody possibly steal it? You know, it's trash. Like, you throw it away because you don't want it. And so she learned that day that once you throw it away, that it's basically public. That once it's on the curb, it's up for grabs that anybody can take it. And that the information that you put in the trash, essentially, you know, it should be something that is of no monetary value to you whatsoever. That certainly it shouldn't be able to be used against you to steal your identity. And that's a lesson that I think that, you know, most people have not effectively learned. that if you throw away anything that has any personal information, any private data, any account numbers, that if you put anything in the trash that will, in the wrong hands, cause your identity to be compromised, then that's your fault. You know, that's your problem.
And actually, I think I can probably one-up you on your story. I do a lot of crime reporting, and mostly about missing kids and stuff. And as a consequence, I've got to know a number of investigators and bounty hunters. Well, if you remember back when O.J. Simpson first got himself in trouble in Las Vegas, right, the bond company involved wanted someone to keep an eye on him because he was a Florida resident. So about 3 weeks ago, UPS dropped off a rather large box. I certainly wasn't expecting it. And it came from one of the investigators that I happen to know. And he was the person tasked with keeping an eye on what OJ was up to while, you know, he was awaiting trial. And inside the box was a very large, loose-leaf file, and it contained all sorts of material that had been recovered from OJ's trash. And I asked him point blank, you know, did you steal this? And he said, nope, it was on public property. So I thumbed my way through this file, and it had all sorts of cell phone information. None of it had been even torn up. I mean, it literally had just been put in the trash. I had the call detail for a month's worth of cell phone records from Arnell Simpson. I had the original, or OJ's original copy of the bond agreement from Las Vegas, you know, with his signature on. Now, okay, I know that OJ's signature is pretty easy to find, but my point is that this file was a little treasure trove of personal information.
Yeah.
It just blew my mind.
Yeah, and that's essentially how easily information could be attained in that regard. So the root of the problem that we're facing right now in the United States and in many other parts of the world is that certainly the speed of technology has outpaced the necessary security to keep our data and information secure. So the real root of the issue is the fact that to this very day, you and I have not been effectively identified. So there's no real system in place right now that effectively authenticates who is who. So I can say that I'm you, and there's really no system in place that says that I'm not. So, for example, in the United States, obviously, we're identified. Our national ID is our Social Security number. That is our primary identifier. It's linked to most of our financial accounts, in to our driving histories, our criminal records, where we've gone to school, our medical histories. It's pretty much linked to, you know, wherever you've signed up for any type of an account at any given time, especially revolving around insurances and so forth. And that Social Security number was never meant to have as much responsibility as it does today. That it was only meant for Social Security benefits back in the 30s, and over the years, something called functionality creep crept in, and the Social Security number eventually had a ton more responsibility than what it was originally intended for. So with functionality creep, the Social Security number becomes a primary identifier. Now, that said, we are identified based on our Social Security number, which is a Social Security card, and there's about 49 versions of the Social Security card in circulation, so there's no rhyme or reason to what a Social Security card is supposed to look like. They're just paper documents that are blue with squiggly lines that can be easily compromised with a desktop printer and scanner and so forth. So that one technology of a computer and scanner and printer has completely outdated and antiquated the Social Security card. Further, we are identified via a driver's license. There's about 200 different forms of driver's licenses in different forms of ID in the United States. So state to state, it varies tremendously as to what a form of identification is supposed to look like. There's very little standardization in the driver's license or IDs from state to state. So that said, depending on where you are in the country, if you present a Virginia driver's license in California, who's supposed to know what's a real one and what's a fake one? There's no rhyme or reason to these identifying documents. The security in a driver's license generally isn't all that sufficient. We use holograms and foils and all kinds of stuff that can be found in some of the toys in the gumball machine at the end of the checkout counter at the supermarket. So while there are some relatively tamper-proof forms of identification out there, they're not ubiquitous in society. They're just, segmented in corporations as access control, but not a significant part of our form of identification for everyday citizens. And then we use a birth certificate as an identifier as well. Now, we're born, we get our papers, which are our birth certificates. We get a Social Security number, which is basically our primary identifier in licenses. We're identified no differently than a pet is, with tags and licenses and identifiers and so forth. And that birth certificate, there's right now 14,000 variations of the birth certificate in circulation. So depending on where and when you were born will depend on what your birth certificate looks like. State to state, there's no rhyme or reason to what that document is supposed to be. Now, when I was 17, I had a girlfriend at the time, and her brother was 24, and I knew back then that, if you want to get into a bar, if you want to buy alcohol, you got to have yourself a fake ID, right? And so somebody told me back then that if you were to get a birth certificate and a Social Security card, and you go to the Registry of Motor Vehicles, that you can get a real driver's license with your picture but somebody else's information on it, okay? This is back like 25 or so years ago, more, 30 years ago, and I was like, really? You can actually do that. You can get a fake ID that easily? So I did. My girlfriend at the time, her brother, allowed me to take his birth certificate and his Social Security card, go to the Registry of Motor Vehicles, and I got a real driver's license saying that I was 24 years old. And it was that easy. And you know what? Today, 2010, it's not much different. It's just as easy to do that. That the system hasn't tightened up to the point where they've made that impossible. And anybody with a scanner and a printer can basically create a Social Security card. They can create a birth certificate. And they can use those two documents to breed a real form of ID. That the system is still that flawed today. And it's still that easy to basically become somebody else. And go ahead.
I don't know if you're much of a fiction reader, but there was a wonderful book that Frederick Forsyth wrote, The Day of the Jackal. And this was back in the 70s. And, his big revelation was how to get a passport. And all you had to do was find someone dead that was around your age, request their birth certificate, and then send off a passport application, and voila, there you are. I think they have somewhat tightened up that loophole today, but, I remember reading this and going, my God, where is the security in this?
Yeah, exactly. And while the system certainly has tightened up a bit, there are certainly ways around it. And whether you steal the identity of a dead person, which has been done plenty of times, Dave from Wendy's, the spokesperson for Wendy's, or the owner of Wendy's, his identity was stolen after he passed. So that's actually a common occurrence. And while someone may have a difficult time getting a passport under somebody's name via the legal and legitimate channel, it's still possible. And if they don't get it through legitimate channels, they can get one counterfeit as well. That there are plenty of places to get them online where you can buy a passport that is basically, you know, pseudo-legit. So we're relying on these paper documents that have no real security in them or have no real connection to who you are. It's just a document that may or may not have a picture of you in it that's supposed to be you that isn't physically connected to you in any way. Even right now, there are 14 states in the United States right now that produce some form of identification that does not have a photo on it. Now, think about that. We're talking about state and federal-issued forms of identification with no picture on them. Like, we're a third-world country. We're producing identification with no photos. Even in the state of Vermont, it's an option to have your photo on your driver's license. Certain states, even the feds, offer airline pilot licenses with no picture on them. So, you know, someone can fly a guided missile with an ID with no picture on it. So we're functioning in an antiquated system that allows and fosters fraud. All of these systems that we function under right now are based on what I call the honor system. That as long as people are honest and they're doing what they're supposed to and they're providing legitimate documentation, that we shouldn't have any problems. That the honor system is one that is based on the ideal that we are all sheep and there are no wolves. And the fact remains that there are plenty of wolves out there and they're scoffing up sheep left and right and they're getting fatter and fatter every day.
I want to move on to the various different types of identity theft and crime out there. I've heard of something called card skimming, and I think I sort of know what it is, but can you explain how card skimming works?
Yes, well, there are a number of different types of identity theft, and one is, credit card fraud. Credit card fraud is there's a few types of credit card fraud, card skimming being one of them. People are most concerned, most people are concerned about credit card fraud as it relates to somebody using their existing credit card without their authorization. And many people, they always ask me, how do I protect my credit card? And my answer is, well, don't use it, because every time you use it, there's an opportunity for somebody to steal those numbers, because those 16 digits on your credit card are worth, whatever the balance is or credit limit is on your card. There are a few types of credit card fraud, the first being new account fraud. New account fraud is when someone will open up a brand new credit card under your name using your social security number. They basically will get your social, apply for credit, get credit under your name, get that new credit card under your name. They max out that credit card. And then ultimately, they don't pay the bill. They get all those goods and services. You get stuck with the bill because the bill collectors will eventually find you, the identity theft victim, and want you to pay for what the identity thief did under your name. That's new account fraud. And then there's account takeover. Account takeover also involves ATM skimming or card skimming. Account takeover is when you have your credit card in your wallet. You might use it online. You might use it over the phone. You might use it at a point of sale where you go and you swipe your card. You give it to the clerk or the waiter or the waitress or the gas station attendant. And then before you know it, there are unauthorized charges made to your credit card. Now, those happen in a number of different ways. Simply, somebody copies down the data, and they go ahead and they make phone calls or use the internet, or they can even basically create what's called a white card or a blank ATM card, where they have a card where they burn your data onto the magnetic strip of that card, and they might go and use that at a self-checkout, at a gas pump, and so forth, and they make charges to your account using a blank ATM card, a blank credit card, a debit card that they burnt the data onto. That is account takeover. Now, account takeover happens, again, simply you just handing the card to somebody, or that data being hacked. So a criminal hacker somewhere in the world accesses a database that has your information on it, or skimming. Card skimming is when the waiter, waitress, gas station attendant, whoever, takes your card and they swipe the card through what's called a wedge device. A wedge is basically records the information off the magnetic strip. And once they have that data, again, they burn it onto a white card. But at ATM machines, what they do is, and this is brilliant, they actually have technology in the form of hardware that they affix to the face of the ATM machine. Now, the skimming device looks like it belongs on the face of the ATM. They put it right over the card slot on the ATM machine. So you walk up to an ATM machine, you put your card in, you think you're just, you know, putting your card into the regular ATM machine and there's no problem or no security issue, but what's in front of that card slot, and the card will still work, it'll still go into the machine and everything, but what's in front of the card slot is a small device that literally fits perfectly over the face and will actually extract the information off of the card. It actually, you know, reads the data off of the magnetic strip. Now, what the criminals do is they actually put a small pinhole camera on the face of the ATM machine in a way that also gets your PIN code. So somewhere on the machine, there might be a brochure holder that is in an inconspicuous area that inside that brochure holder, there might be a small wireless camera, and it's pointed down towards you, the PIN pad. So when you punch in the PIN code, and it gets your PIN number, and it's already swiped the data off the magnetic strip. It could be behind a brochure holder, or in some states, like in New York, for example, they are required by law to have a mirror on the face of the ATM so that you can detect if somebody's behind you shoulder surfing trying to get your PIN code. So that mirror on the face of the ATM is supposed to be there. But what the criminals do is they'll put an additional mirror on the ATM machine, and behind that mirror is a small box, and inside that box is a small wireless camera that works off of a 9-volt battery. And yeah, it's brilliant, actually. And so now they have your PIN code, they have the information off the magnetic strip. At the end of the day, they go, they retrieve that skimming device, they pull it off the face of the ATM machine, and they basically take it back to the boiler room operation, they download the data off of the skimming device, and they burn that white card that I was talking about. And they go to an ATM machine at any time of the day. Now they have a white card, a blank ATM card with your data on it. They know what your PIN code is because they recorded it from the small wireless camera. They put the card in. They punch in your PIN. They take the maximum dollar amount out for the day, which is generally about $500, and then they'll do the exact same thing the next day. So often what the criminal will do is they'll show up to the ATM machine at, let's say, 5 minutes to midnight, take out the maximum dollar amount, wait till after midnight, and do the exact same thing because it's another calendar day. They'll take out another $500. They'll do this until they drain your bank account or until you recognize that your card's been compromised. The problem with this type of fraud is that the banks generally don't believe the victim, that they don't have any inclination to want to believe the victim, because when the money's taken out of your account, that's ultimately, you know, if they have to reimburse you, that's their money. So when your account is compromised, they don't want to give you the money back, so there's always a fight involved there. I often recommend that people don't actually use a debit card, that you use a credit card, that a credit card actually has a little more security built into it, that you have about 60 days to refute any unauthorized charges when your credit card is compromised, whereas sometimes you might have less than a week to refute charges if your debit card is compromised. So credit cards versus debit cards, I always go with a credit card opposed to a debit card. And even if your debit card is compromised, you know, that's money directly out of your bank account, whereas if it's a credit card, that's, you know, the credit card company's money. So you have up to 60 days with the credit card, sometimes up to 30 days with a debit card, sometimes less than a week. So it's really important in either case scenario to pay very, very close attention to your statements, bank statements, credit card statements, and refute unauthorized charges within a 60-day period of time. I generally will look at my statements every couple of weeks online so that I'm looking to see, you know, if there have been any unauthorized charges and refute them as soon as possible.
You recently had an adventure with an ATM. I was shocked and horrified when I read your article. Can you tell us about what you did?
Yeah, I had fun with an ATM machine. If one can have fun with an ATM, I did. You know, there's a convention that takes place every year in the United States in August in Las Vegas, of all places, called DEFCON.
Yes.
DEFCON is a convention of hackers. Now, hackers have been going to the DEFCON convention since the early 90s. I think it was 91 and 92. And the first, you know, convention had, you know, just like under 100 people, under 100 hackers. And now today's DEFCON convention has thousands and thousands of people who show up to DEFCON. And, you know, it's a legitimate gig. You know, anybody can go to DEFCON. You don't actually pre-register. You show up in person, and you can only pay cash to get in. They don't accept checks and credit cards for obvious reasons. And once you get into DEFCON, you're basically learning, you know, about all kinds of new technologies and new hacks and ways to compromise this or that or crack that or secure this. And there's all kinds of hackers at DEFCON. There's good hackers. There's bad hackers. There's hackers that are kind of in the middle. The CIA, FBI, Secret Service, you know, the security professionals. Everybody's there to learn about hacking. There was black hats.
Is it indeed true that there is a prize for spotting the Fed?
Spotting the Fed basically is a game they play. If you could spot a federal agent, you know, you win some type of a prize. And they have another game where they see if they can break into a certain network and get the data and so forth. I mean, this is what they do, and they're good at it. And these are inventive, intelligent, adventurous people. Some of them, you know, have nothing but good intentions, and some have nothing but bad. And at this year's DEFCON convention was a ATM machine that somebody rolled into the convention facility. So somebody took an ATM machine where they either made it or they bought it or they reconfigured it. They rolled it into the convention and they put it right in front of the security office at the convention hotel. So there was no security cameras right in front of security, and they rolled this ATM machine and hackers began to hack hackers. That somebody began to steal the credit, debit card, and PIN codes of hackers. And so when I saw, and this made national news, it got a lot of attention because it was at DEFCON, hackers hacking hackers, and via ATM skimming. And I said to myself at that time, I said, this is just too easy. Like, how is it that anybody can just do something like this? And what I did was I did a little experiment. I went online, and right off the bat, I was able to find ATM machines on the internet. That if you go to eBay, if you go to Craigslist, there are ATM machines all over the place for sale. I didn't think that it should be that easy. So I found an ATM machine at a bar north of Boston where I reside, and they were selling pool tables, Budweiser signs, and an ATM machine at this bar that was closing down. And so I went up to the bar, and I met the guy, Bob, who was selling this ATM machine. He was asking $1,000 for it. And I brought my hacker. I have a hacker that I brought with me that, you know, is very good at technology. He's a penetration tester. He basically looks for vulnerabilities in people's networks. And he's a little more savvy than I am as far as, like, reading the manual and understanding how things work. And he went through the controls of this ATM machine. We determined that, okay, this thing, you know, it works, it does what it's supposed to. Let's buy it. Let's see what we can get out of it. So we buy this ATM machine from this guy named Bob at this bar, and I ended up, you know, chewing him down to $750. and we roll the thing home, we, you know, get it to my garage, and when you have an ATM machine in your garage, for whatever reason, it makes for a restless night of sleep. Like, you just don't sleep that well. It's like Christmas the next day. And we wake up the next morning, and my hacker comes over, and he has the manual in hand, and he goes over to the ATM machine. He goes, watch this. He punches in a bunch of codes to the ATM machine and out spits over 1,000 credit and debit card numbers from the purchase.
What?
So the ATM machine still had the people's data on it that were using the machine. So I bought this machine to kind of demonstrate ATM skimming and how it works and how you could just roll this ATM machine anywhere and people will use it, you can get their data. And I bought it, and it already had 1,000 credit and debit card numbers on it, which was a surprising find to me. I wasn't expecting that, but obviously, you know, I was thrilled with the find. Disappointed that a machine like this could store that kind of data and that there wasn't any existing technology built into it that would prevent me or anyone from getting it. So that was a little disheartening. And since then, we basically took the machine and we rolled it all around Boston. And wherever we put this machine, and when I tell you, we just put it right up against a building outside of anywhere, people would begin to use the ATM machine. And when they used it, we were able to get credit card and debit card numbers because the machine records their data automatically. We didn't even have to use an ATM skimming device. We just got it automatically because the machine records it. And then via a pinhole camera, we were able to demonstrate that you can also get a person's PIN code as well. Now, out in the field, we didn't actually use the pinhole camera because, you know, there's no sense in getting people's pins, but we showed how we demonstrated on camera how it's easy to do. And the mere fact that anybody can buy an ATM machine on Craigslist or on eBay and they can roll this thing around and commit these crimes and get raw data from a used ATM machine tells me that the ATM industry isn't doing enough to regulate who can buy, who can sell an ATM machine, who can dispense cash. So you can be a convicted felon, a convicted criminal, and you can just buy an ATM machine and get into the cash dispensing business and get people's personal information. That, to me, is bothersome. And I've received, you know, some ridicule from the industry. I've certainly stirred some controversy in that regard because, you know, I expose a flaw in the system, one that allows for a criminal hacker to roll an ATM machine into DEFCON or anywhere else. And if you can hack hackers, then you can easily hack the public.
Oh, yes. You know, I mentioned earlier that I cover a lot of news stories, and as a result, I have a number of, let's say, colorful friends. And I was talking to one of my, or actually a couple of my colorful friends recently, and most of them subscribe to some online services, and they seem to be able to dig up confidential data with absolute ease. Social security numbers, names, addresses, you know, it's easy. And, you know, while on the one hand they're performing a valuable task, they're trying to track down criminals, on the other hand, I'm absolutely alarmed at the lack of regulation to access to this kind of information. I mean, all I've got to do is fess up my credit card number, and away I go. I can find any information I want. You know, it's not licensed. I mean, should it be licensed?
You know, there has always been information available about people at one level or another. One of the largest supplier of data to citizens is the U.S. government. The U.S. government has what's called the vital statistics offices at most, you know, state offices, cities and towns have a vital statistics. And vital statistics, basically, like the city clerk, let's say, they're the ones that have all of the names and addresses of all the town's residents. They have the deeds to homes. They have the assessments of the properties. All that information is public. It's readily available to the public via the U.S. government. And it's been like that for dozens and dozens of years, since the early 70s, actually. And that said, you know, you can get somebody's birth certificate via the U.S. government. You can get a death certificate, via a marriage certificate, a deed to a home, all via the U.S. government. This has been going on forever. And that said, you know, it's perfectly legal that that's available. The problem, in my opinion, is not the fact that you can buy this data, the fact that it's out there, that it's readily available. I don't see that as an issue. See, it is necessary in this day and age to vet out a potential boyfriend or girlfriend. It's necessary to vet out a potential person who's going to be watching your children like a nanny. It's necessary to vet out somebody who you may be hiring to come into your organization to work for you. Because if you're a real estate broker and you hire somebody who in the past has committed real estate fraud, it would be good to know ahead of time if they've done that, if they've committed that type of crime. So it's absolutely necessary that we have these services to protect you from the bad guy, to know if you're bringing the bad guy into your organization. So, but that said, in my opinion, it's really not about the fact that information is out there available about you. The idea, I think, is to make sure that data is useless to the bad guy, to the thief, let's say, so that your identity is protected, so that somebody can't just pose as you. Because whether you are purchasing it online or you're searching it online, most people give away pretty much everything about them on Facebook. You know, whatever is available for sale in some places is available for free. You know, people I see on Facebook, they talk about the fact that, you know, they have all this is their pet's name, these are their kids' names, this is where they live, this is their phone number, this is, you know, their favorite pizza, and all of those questions are the same questions that are required to answer when you're signing up for a new email account. And these are all the qualifying questions or different questions, security questions, that in case you forget your password, you answer a few questions and you get your password back, you know, emailed to you, let's say. And those answers to all those questions are in somebody's Facebook page. I see people all the time.
In fact, that's exactly what happened to Sarah Palin, as I recall.
Exactly. Perfect example. And I see people all the time who say that they are, you know, their toes are dug in the sand, they're in Acapulco having a margarita, wish you were here. And they're posting that on their Facebook page. They're posting that on their Twitter profile. And so they're basically telling the world that we're not home, so if you want to go break into our house, we're about, you know, 1,000 miles away. So I think that's a problem, that when you put your information out there in that regard, that's a risk. I think that people need to be conscious of what they're putting out there in the web. I think that, you know, it's good to be able to vet somebody out, but ultimately your responsibility is not to secure your privacy, but to secure your identity in a way where you lock it down to make the data useless to the thief. That really is where we are. Like, privacy has been an illusion for quite some time. Security, however, is something that we should be focusing on, because security really, you know, ultimately is what protects your credit, protects your family. It's really about security at this point, and that needs to be the public's focus.
We're rapidly running out of time, but do you have a website where people can find out more information and maybe contact you if they feel they could use your services?
Absolutely. You could do one of two things. You know, I'm always here. My entire life's motivation is to educate and inform and to help people, you know, to protect themselves. You could see me online at idtheftsecurity.com. Again, that's idtheftsecurity.com. If you're interested in identity theft protection, there's two things I want you to do. You can go online to intellius.com. That's intellius.com. Intellius.com offers ID Protect, which basically monitors your information on the Internet. It basically monitors your credit reports, so if there's any inquiries into your credit reports, they inform you of it so you can lock down your identity in that respect. And that also, too, get yourself what's called a credit freeze. a credit freeze. Basically, there's a fee behind that as well. Do a search online for state security freeze laws. Again, that's state security freeze laws, and get yourself a credit freeze. A credit freeze will lock down your credit report so that it will make it difficult, if not impossible, for somebody to open up new accounts under your name. So between Intellius ID Protect and a credit freeze, that's like two of the best things that you could do to protect your identity. And in this day and age, with 10 million people being victimized every single year, it's absolutely essential to lock down your identity.
I'm going to change the subject once again. I see a lot of material that the average man in the street does not. I'm a reviewer, and I'm on all sorts of distribution lists. I get press releases about data forensic devices, items that likely have zero interest to the man in the street. You know, their intended target are data forensics experts, either government or private. And these devices permit secure and usually stealthy copying of information from computers, PDAs, cell phones, etc. You know, it's
spyware.
Right. They leave no trace on the target object, and some boast the ease and speed. Just plug the cell phone in, and 20 seconds later, you've sucked out all of the information. What a boon to the would-be thief.
Yeah.
How often do people leave their cell phones unattended for a couple of minutes? I mean, should these forensic devices be regulated in some form? In fact, I have one sitting in front of me. It's called the USB write blocker. Plug in any USB mass storage device. I can pull out all of the data. And if you think about it, people tend to store a lot of information in their cell phones and PDAs. I mean, all I got to do is plug my little doohickey in, and it's gone. I've got it.
Yeah,
I mean,
those same doohickeys are available for cellular phones, for computers, where you plug a device in that records all your keystrokes. It's essentially spyware, keyloggers, key catchers, hardware, software that record data. Those devices have been around, you know, ever since computers have been around, more and more prevalent, you know, today than ever. That said, you need to know that whenever you use a public PC, whenever you're out there in the wild, let's say, that if you are using a library terminal or a business center PC at the hotel you're staying at, that your data can easily be recorded. You put your cellular phone down for 5 seconds, somebody can get all kinds of data off of it. The idea is to ultimately make the data useless to the thief. And that, you know, again, means identity theft protection. It means changing up your passwords. It means making sure that you change your passwords, you know, to something that is difficult to record or difficult to crack and so forth. Once the data is compromised, then the hacker, the bad guy, can let loose on your accounts. So it's very important, you know, to react, to pay close attention to your statements, to make sure that every single week or every couple of weeks or every single month you're looking for any inaccuracies, you're looking for any unauthorized charges, any unauthorized withdrawals. I mean, you have to pay close attention. In this digital world, all these conveniences that we use every day, and that's what they are, online banking, ordering over the internet and so forth, these are all conveniences. And so the speed of technology is generally far outpaced the speed of security. So you really need to pay attention if you're going to use all these conveniences, because there are technologies that can compromise your data. So pay close attention, refute unauthorized charges, look at your accounts, and, you know, keep an awareness about you, because you can't simply just think that the bank or the credit card company are going to protect you. Ultimately, your responsibility for protecting yourself.
Our time is absolutely up here. Robert, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us today. I think we should schedule another program, because I still have lots and lots and lots of questions for you.
Thank you. Well, happy to do it. You know, and in the meantime, check me out online at idtheftsecurity.com or intellius.com for identity theft protection.
Right, and I suggest that everyone does. Identity theft is a really huge problem these days. In fact, I had something hit close to home about a month ago. Robert, again, thank you so much, and I do wish you a great day and great success in stamping out this nasty white-collar crime.
You're a gentleman. Thanks so much for your time.
Okay, goodbye.